This is Healthcare Matters on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Healthcare Matters is a program that delves into healthcare policy and issues. The hosts are not medical clinicians, and they're not able to offer advice about medical conditions or diseases. You're always encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Healthcare Matters, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, hosted by Rebecca Stewart and Elliot Joseph. We're healthy, you're healing.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Healthcare Matters on WTIC 1080 News Talk Radio. This is Elliot Joseph. I am here with my co-host, Rebecca Stewart. And as you know, our show has been about transforming healthcare. And today, one of the biggest transformations we have seen over the years is the move towards telehealth or telemedicine. This morning, we're going to delve a little deeper into this incredible technology and service, where we are, where we've been, and where it's going, what are its limitations, and what are the opportunities. And it's amazing that many of us still cannot fathom receiving our health care without a hands-on encounter with a real person. However, telehealth has been around longer than you think, and it's having a significant impact on access to high-quality care. There actually are reports from as far back as the 1940s, of sharing records electronically in Pennsylvania, and in the 60s, a Florida medical school partnered with the first responders to help them take care of cardiac arrest patients in the field. But of course, fast forward to today, and it's unbelievable what's happening. An entire new level of care, and the pace is accelerating. Today, actually, more than 50% of American hospitals are in some way or another deploying telehealth into their community.
And this is a great conversation as we delve into, certainly many of you have heard of virtual appointments, virtual counseling, wearable devices. Some health systems have virtual hospitals and technology, of course, moving quickly. Still, though, a lot of unanswered questions and unexplored territory. What does telemedicine look like now? What will it look like tomorrow? So let's get right to our amazing guests that we have today.
And we ain't seen nothing yet is, I think, the theme of our show this morning.
I like it.
Today, we have Dr. David Houghton with us. Dr. Houghton is the medical director of CareConnect 360 at the Ochsner Health Center. Dr. Houghton has helped to bring care from the city of New Orleans to more rural areas across Louisiana. His work has helped to transform care in the state and beyond. He's earned his medical degree from the Medical College of Georgia and his master's in public health and epidemiology at Emory. He completed his internship and residency in neurology at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. We also have Dr. Amre New with us, who is also a neurologist, and he is the system director of the stroke program for Hartford Healthcare. Additionally, in studio today is Chris Peterson, who is the director of telehealth for all of Hartford Healthcare. Chris began his career as a physical therapist, and he's helped to pilot the first telehealth and telerehab programs at HHC. Later in the show, we'll be joined by Dr. John Santapietro. He'll be calling in, and he is the physician-in-chief of the Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network, Connecticut's leading provider of addiction and mental health services. And John is a nationally recognized leader and has published and lectured extensively on the use of technology to enhance the delivery of behavioral health services. Strap in. It's going to be a great conversation.
It is a great show. We're going to start this morning with Dr. David Houghton. Now, David, as the medical director of CareConnect 360, we're going to set the stage. Can you take us through from the most basic level, sort of what, in your opinion, from your experience, what is telehealth? And thanks for being on our show.
Well, thank you, Rebecca, and thank you, Elliot. It's my pleasure to have a chance to call in and discuss this really important step forward in the care of patients across the country. Telehealth or telemedicine, and I tend to use the terms a bit interchangeably, really describes unique new opportunities to connect patients with providers within their healthcare system to try to maintain health and wellness, but also be reactive to illness in as many different ways to consider the connectivity. And so traditionally, telemedicine, we've utilized that term to think about either an asynchronous relationship where you're storing and forwarding information from a patient to a provider, or even the synchronous audio-video connections for those doctor-patient relationships. And telehealth was utilized to discuss sort of everything else in the solar system around that, connections through chart applications, through email, different types of chat bots, the ability to connect digitally. But I think at this point, because it's becoming so much more ubiquitous, and because telehealth really is eventually going to be the way that we discuss all types of health, we should just consider it as such.
I like that. I like the point, and I love this journey that you'd been on. Now, you, of course, are based in very busy, beautiful city of New Orleans, but your system's responsible for the care of so many different rural communities. Take us through how this has really expanded access to the people who need it the most, who can't get to you.
Sure. And I was reminded of the difference between our geography this morning when I heard that the weather report up in Connecticut is quite different than what we're experiencing down here for Jazz Fest. It'll be 80 degrees and sunny in New Orleans.
All right. Move on. 80 degrees, sunny, and Jazz Fest.
Right.
0 for 3 here.
But you're absolutely correct, Rebecca, that the push for us to create these new virtual connections really came from the people of our state. We recognize that we have a significantly rural patient population in the Gulf South. There is lack of access to often the specialists that they need to maintain the high quality of health care and quality of life that they come to deserve and expect. And so we really started looking at this 20 years ago. Two decades ago, we realized that pediatric cardiologists were spending a lot of windshield time driving to various clinics across the state, or some of the most vulnerable children with cardiac defects were having that same windshield time spent getting down to Ochsner in New Orleans. And so we were able to utilize technology to review pediatric echocardiograms and EKGs. Fast forward to about 10 years ago when we launched our telestroke program, and I'm very excited to hear the experience of Dr. New here today. Ours was probably very similar to what you have built, in the sense that we recognized that we had specialists in the bricks and mortar of New Orleans that were not able to provide that highest level of care to other rural patients across the state. And in fact, as we've now built our system to more than 50 hospitals that are connected through our telestroke network, to more than 350 strokes that we manage per month, even some of the smallest, most rural critical access hospitals that previously had patients diverted from them. They weren't able to stay in their community to receive the high-quality care and rehab closer to home and closer to their family. Now, 70% of the patients that end up connecting through us via our telestroke network are able to stay at home in those communities. So this has been a win for the state of Louisiana, and it's been those experiences that have then colored our opportunities to be able to build more direct-to-provider programs. We're connecting physicians to physicians, and direct-to-patient programs where we're connecting patients directly with us in places as easy as their home, at work, or on vacation.
Yeah, David, why is stroke care been such a good candidate for telehealth, telemedicine as a starting point? I'm interested in your point of view about this, and also I'd like to hear Dr. New's perspective as well. David, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So I think the most important thing that Dr. New and I know is that time is brain. And so if a patient presents in their small community with signs and symptoms of a stroke, which may be something like slurred speech or diminished use of one side of the body, imbalance, even dizziness and vomiting, those time matters more than anything else. And those patients need to be evaluated and considered for the leading clot-busting medication called TPA as soon as possible. So if they were in an ambulance and they were going by a hospital that was unable to take care of them, every second lost is brain cells lost. And so we realized that to have the vascular trained neurologist, the specialist, to be able to help those ER docs and those communities make those decisions as fast as they can to give the clot-busting medicine, it's resulted in a remarkable difference for those communities. And I'd love to hear Dr. New's opinion on it as well.
Yeah, Dr. New, please.
Yeah, I can't agree more. I mean, essentially, stroke lends itself this unique space where it's prime for telemedicine. Essentially, somebody coming in at any hour of the day, as you know, stroke doesn't respect the holidays or the weekend or anything. It will strike whenever. And when patients do roll in, somebody has to be there to evaluate them and look at imaging and make a critical decision. And the beauty of telehealth here in telemedicine is to be able remotely to evaluate somebody, examine them, and look at the images and make an, you know, a decision to treat because of the time sensitivity. In fact, I think it was only in 2016 when the American Heart and Stroke Association put out a scientific statement about telehealth, and that's kind of telestroke care. That's kind of the first, I would say, official recommendation and or best practices parameters, a document that came out about this, despite that. Yeah.
So that was 2016, you said, and here we are in only 2019. And Dr. Houghton, tell us a little bit about the expansion of your program in New Orleans, because the one of the key points here is the accelerated pace of the development of how we apply this technology to a much broader spectrum of patients.
Yeah, thanks, Elliot. So I think on the backbone of the success of a telestroke program and recognizing that we were fortunate enough to be a large group practice here in the Gulf South, you know, we have more than 1,300 physicians, 25,000 employees, 40 owned and affiliated hospitals across the region. We felt a unique opportunity to be able to utilize this technology in some new and exciting ways. So if you think about telestroke in the ER, we have then built similar emergency programs on things like pediatric subspecialty care. We have a telepsychiatry program that has now cut the wait time for our smallest hospitals across the state to have psychiatric evaluations cut by two-thirds of the time. We built a tele-ICU where we have a bunker that's built monitoring more than 200 beds per night across our system. That's a second set of eyes and ears with critical care nurses and critical care physicians. And we're probably most proud, most recently, of a program that we've called TeleStork, which is a cleverly named outfit where laboring mothers and babies are monitored in a similar fashion as what we built with tele-ICU. We saw that there was a unique way to have a second set of eyes and ears to watch the strips of the laboring mothers, be able to monitor fetal heart tones, monitor the potential complications that may arise. And we're really proud to say that we've been able to cut our number of ICU admissions of full-term babies in half as a result of some of the interventions that we've built on the hospital and clinic side.
As we delve into some of the folks who are here, one of the things that I want to set the stage for our audience, our listeners today, when you're talking about this tele-ICU, one of the things that was pretty interesting to me was how you had talked about bringing these were off-site of your actual hospitals, and that was very deliberate. Can you set the stage for why you needed all those nurses and the monitors at a separate location? Because you were afraid of what?
Well, we were afraid of falling back on old habits and the practice of just dashing down the back stairwell to help take care of a patient who may be in need. Now, that wasn't in the sense that we thought that we were going to be compromising care either. We just knew for a program where we were providing backup, we really wanted to fully engage that bunker with what they could do to access those patients remotely and really test the technology. And in fact, it's similar to, again, hearing about the weather patterns of wet snow up there. We don't get a lot of wet snow, but we do get a fair number of hurricanes and summer storms. And so several of our hospitals that are utilizing this are going to rely on our bunker. And so we put our tele-ICU bunker at a part of town where we've got a multi-generated and historically has not been susceptible to weather changes. So we really feel like that's going to be the safest, best place for us to continue to push these programs forward.
Fascinating. Now, here we have Chris Peterson. You've been sitting here patiently. So tell us your thoughts of all of this, hearing all the different aspects. You are the director of telehealth at Hartford Healthcare, and I know you have a lot of irons in the fire, projects in the works.
Well, I feel honored. I feel honored to be a part of this whole story. And over the past 6 years, it really has evolved quite a bit. It's all about connecting to the patient, and kind of the discussion that we're having here is around connecting valuable resources in the way of specialists to patients that really need care. And it, in my mind, it really boils down to doing what's right for the patient at the right time and building the internal capability to understand that better and better as we move forward.
Chris, tell us about the tele-rehab program that you were part of starting up as a pilot at Hartford.
Yeah, so that was one of my first passion projects around telehealth. And what we did is we took a conventionally hands-on profession, which is physical therapy, and we looked at the literature and we saw that this has been done before. And we connected patients with physical therapists after they had a total knee replacement, which again is was controversial at the time because that's a rehab that's often associated with hands-on work. And what we found is that patients got better just as well. In fact, we had some trouble measuring that because what we found is that even in our historic in-person visits, we don't always measure how they're doing before they have surgery.
So how does it work? Walk us through a little bit of it's a little hard for those who haven't experienced it to actually understand how I could get physical therapy remotely.
So it's actually pretty simple. The patient has an iPad, and at that point, it was in 2015, so we were actually providing the iPad to the patient because I wanted to take that out as a potential barrier as we started our first project. So they would get the iPad. They would have some experience before surgery with how to turn it on. They'd go home on the day on a scheduled time. The physical therapist would connect with them on the iPad on a video conference that was secure. We vetted out. And they also had access to an electronic copy of all of the therapist's recommendations. And if they had trouble, they could text the therapist in real time, which actually was one of the most powerful aspects of the project. Hmm. That got utilized a lot. And I think that it really helped the patient's anxiety as they, you know, really felt like they needed more help.
And so I can see the therapist and the therapist can see me while this is real time.
It's real time. It's real time, but there's also a component of asynchronous. So when we finish that real time connection, all of the recommendations from that session get delivered to the patient so they can see photos of the exercises they're supposed to do, and they also get directions from the therapist.
Got it.
And I remember when looking at some of those pictures, seeing the therapist in action saying, okay, look at how I'm moving my leg. I want you to do that. And then offering some critiques and criticism saying, I need you to move it this way. Oh, could you move your leg a little bit like that? And you can see that would be really valuable. It's a whole industry when it comes to the exercise industry. That's really what people do. David, your thoughts on all of that as you take a peek at sort of other opportunities. And then I definitely want you to delve into these virtual appointments with your new Care Anywhere kits.
Sure. So Chris, congratulations. I think that is a fantastic program. As a neurologist myself who takes care of patients with Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease, other movement disorders, we are interested in bending your ear about this. We've thought a lot about tele-rehab programs like this, and frankly, you're ahead of the curve. So kudos to you. And to your point, Rebecca, I think that this really helps define why we've expanded our definition of telehealth. The reality is it's not just your expected provider to patient interaction. These are happening with allied health team professionals like physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech pathologists. We're piloting a program doing speech therapy, which lends itself beautifully to an audio video connection. We know that behavioral experts in the world of psychology, social work, and others are critical with telehealth programs going forward. We recognize the value of patient education modules and even resident education models so that we're able to expand what we're doing to train the next level of providers in a world where virtual care will be expected. So Chris, kudos to you. I think it's a great program, and I think it really does speak to the expanse of what telehealth ought to be.
I love that. Take us through this new idea of your Care Anywhere kits. Now, this is sort of putting healthcare in the hands of your patients.
Well, that's right. So, and Chris had mentioned, you know, recognizing barriers to care, like, you know, making sure the patients have the technology of the iPad. We realize that even in a state as rural as ours is, we have 100% access to to cellular technology across the state. 95% to 97% of households have a cell phone. The data is that 75% of households have an iPad or a similar tablet or smartphone technology. We think that number is actually low in the sense that many individuals within a family or a neighborhood will have access to these devices if they're using their sons or their granddaughters. And so we think the numbers are actually even higher than that three quarters. Knowing that, we then delved into the possibility of expanding our direct-to-patient programs. And nowadays, as all of us are consumers in the digital economy of this country, we expect Uber to be available in 5 minutes and Amazon to deliver things in 24 to 48 hours. But I'm not the first one to suggest that hospital care and clinic medicine still feels pretty analog. In fact, I'm reminded daily when we're still relying on the fax machine in my office. But based on that, we knew that our patient population, particularly the younger generation, the millennials, the Generation Z, the ones who are less likely wedded to a primary care physician who they're going to lean on at all times for their urgent and preventive care, we knew that they were demanding these types of programs to come to their own home. And so that's why we launched Ochsner Anywhere Care about 6 months ago. This is a partnership with the large third-party telehealth provider American Well. We went with American Well as a partner because we recognized three important things with them. One, they were the leader and had 10 years of experience data from such large health systems as Cleveland Clinic. Two, they had the technology in their app that allows the providers and the patients to connect in a rideshare type fashion. So it is almost like they Uber in and Uber out, so they're able to keep wait times exceedingly low. And third, they had a 50-state bench of providers to help us in the urgent care world. Now, since we've launched, we have our own urgent care providers who are available on the app. They're there for first pick, if you will, for our patients who have come to expect the local docs to take care of them appropriately. But if you're on vacation in Florida or in Connecticut and you want to connect with someone through the Ochsner Anywhere Health care system, we recognize then that we may not have an urgent care provider who's licensed in Connecticut at that hour. And so partnering with the online care group has been critical.
And I'm curious that even the debate sort of in this room, consumer acceptance of telehealth for these sort of urgent care visits has been slower than folks anticipated. We look at the numbers. We know that in this day and age, there appears to be urgent cares. But I can see the value in a more rural area when there's not one on every corner if you're on vacation. I'm curious for my physicians here, for Elliot, for the folks in this room, what are your thoughts to that?
So I think there's a big psychological barrier, as David had mentioned earlier. For some younger generation folks, it might be more appealing because of the Internet of Things and the examples mentioned. But if you all recall, last month there was a big story in the news, a big healthcare system in California, when the ICU, it was an older gentleman who was dying from lung disease, and there was a younger person in the room, I think the granddaughter in her 30s. And quote unquote, the doc in the box came in and told the patient that you're going to pass away in a couple of days, and that made national headlines because it was not the expectation that a life decision or a prognostic decision of this devastating news was just delivered through telehealth, and that was all over the news and social media blew up about it. So I think the perception piece, this has telehealth and virtual visits have started to break the barrier, but there's still those areas where it might have some downfalls and shortcomings, and the human piece is important.
One of the advantages, it seems to me, particularly with families spread across the country, that this technology allows you as a provider to engage the families in a more real-time way. What's our experience there, Dr. New?
The family piece is critical. I mean, even now, in folks' decision-making processes, prognostication, the family piece is key because there's only so much that a provider or a medical individual can provide, but the buy-in, the compassion that needs to be shared there has to span across you know, the family members. And right now, you know, I find it in my practice personally, I'm sure David yourself, that involving them in any decision-making process is key. And this is an area where this has become very helpful. We've done this in our ICU.
Yeah, we're talking with Dr. Amre New, who is the chief of stroke care at Hartford Healthcare, and Dr. David Houghton from the Ochsner Clinic. David, your point of view about the family engagement, let's just give us a quick answer. We're heading into the news moment in about a minute.
Sure. I think you hit the nail on the head. And while there have been some unfortunate circumstances that hit social media, like the one that you mentioned, where it felt like the expectations of the family weren't met and it wasn't acceptable to them, I think far and away, if we do the right thing, making opportunities for us to make those connections, we actually have better good stories than lousy stories going forward. And we've been in the same situation, our tele-ICU, tele-stroke, telepsychiatry, where you have to deliver bad news. I think we have a unique opportunity and a responsibility to figure out how to expand what our patients come to expect in bedside manner to what we can provide them in what we call website manner.
That is website manner. We're going to talk much more about that when we return. You are listening to Healthcare Matters. We're healthier here.
We are having a great conversation about telehealth and telemedicine. This is Elliot Joseph. I'm here with Rebecca Stewart, my co-host, and we're talking about everything from virtual appointments to virtual counseling to even this notion ultimately of virtual hospitals. There's so much yet to explore and that lies in front of us. And we're having a conversation with some real experts this morning, Dr. David Houghton, the medical director of Care Connect 360 at the Ochsner Clinic in Louisiana. He has worked to and continues to work bringing care out of New Orleans into the more rural areas of Louisiana through this technology. We are also with Dr. Amre New, who is a neurologist and is the system director of the stroke program for Hartford Healthcare, and Chris Peterson, who is the director of telehealth for Hartford Healthcare, who began his career as a physical therapist and saw the promise of telemedicine and has been one of the leaders of development across Hartford Healthcare in telehealth. And we also are being joined by John Santapietro, who's calling in. John is the physician in chief of the Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Healthcare Network and is seen as a national leader in both behavioral health and telemedicine, has published and lectured extensively on the use of technology to enhance the delivery of behavioral health services. John, welcome to our program. Nice to have you here.
Great to be here. It's an amazing show.
All right. Thanks, John. So thank you to all of our guests. And we're going to begin with you, John, to have a perspective on this behavioral health side. We heard David talk a little bit about telepsychiatry. This is something you're very passionate about. So tell us your thoughts on how it helps the patients who may not have access.
Thanks, Rebecca. And absolutely, listening in, it's been incredible to hear Dr. Houghton and Dr. New and Chris talk about, you know, using telehealth to connect to patients. I like that word, and to scale and drive access. And, you know, part of my passion came from the work that I did when I was down at a system in North and South Carolina called Atrium Health, where we had a challenge to integrate behavioral health into 200 primary care offices, if you can imagine that. There's a lot of data to show that if you back up primary care with good behavioral health, that the outcomes are just much better than primary care delivering that behavioral health on their own, which they often have to do because there isn't access to psychiatry. We were able to basically in 2 years before I left get into 70 of those primary care offices and just showed incredible outcomes.
How did it work? Really, how does it work, John?
So it used to be in that system that when somebody came in and said that they were suffering with depression in primary care, there's so much busyness in those offices, there wasn't enough time to really delve in. What happened when we stood up this program, which basically involved a virtual behavioral health team, so 25 people in a bunker, basically, and a very energetic team, one psychiatrist, one nurse practitioner, one
pharmacologists and therapists and coaches, they would be able to call that team and in real time have access to a behavioral health specialist to be able to diagnose the patient and begin consulting with that team about how to initiate a treatment that's going to be effective. And in 2 years, we were able to treat 10,000 people that would otherwise not have had access to behavioral health care and showed incredible outcomes. So the behavioral health scores got better, their depression got better, their anxiety got better. But what really was astounding was that their hemoglobin A1C or their diabetes score basically got better. It dropped a full point and avoidable hospitalizations and avoidable emergency room visits went down, so that when you treat behavioral health care in primary care, you basically avoid downstream suffering and downstream costs.
What a great point. So I do want to pose a question to our listeners this morning. We do want to hear from you. Is this something that you would do? Would you go, I'm sort of envisioning a kiosk, like so many folks have sort of these selfie kiosks out and about. Would you be comfortable? Would you do it from your home? Would that be something you're comfortable doing? We want to hear from you. We want to know your perspective. That number again, 860-522-WTIC, 860-522-9842.
Let's jump over to Chris Peterson for a moment. Chris, you've been at this work now for a number of years at Hartford HealthCare and have built up some pretty cool infrastructure and capability. Tell us a little bit about where we are today and where we're headed.
Yeah, thanks. So one of the things that we have built is an integrated video visit within Epic. So from a technology perspective, we're prepared to deliver video visits to patients and their experiences. They can connect right from their home using their own device, connecting directly to MyChart.
And MyChart, for our listeners, is your online medical electronic record. So this is a way to get into that record and sort of do it privately, securely.
But bigger than that, there's a discussion of trust that goes on around this. So how do we kind of walk ourselves from both sides, really, from the patient and the customer side and our side as providers into doing this the right way. So we've built some training programs that will allow providers to feel comfortable as they engage in telehealth. And we've also built some materials in the way that we communicate with patients so that they feel more comfortable about what it is that we're trying to do, which is really just expand the same high-quality care that we're delivering in person a little bit further.
Yeah, so this idea of trust, I've been thinking about it as we're talking about this, and back to Dr. Santapietro in behavioral health world, how does that play out when you have people who have not met their providers and the first time they're meeting them is through some video capability? I'm a little skeptical, I have to say, about this. So tell us about it.
Yeah, and we were curious about it as well, Elliot, and very much wanted to check in with our consumers and our patients as it went along, and were delightfully surprised to find that they actually quite enjoyed it. In some cases, actually, in behavioral health, believe it or not, people have had experiences of trauma, etc., it can feel safer to them to have a telehealth connection with the provider than actually to be in a room with one other person, which can seem sometimes a little heightened in terms of their anxiety. One of the other things in behavioral health that's worth mentioning is that 60% of people that are suffering with behavioral health conditions get no care at this point in the country. So it's important to think about the fact that we're getting care to people that are expecting not to get it, and that plays a role as well.
Yeah, so let's go back. Thank you. Let's go back. I'm going to go to Dr. New regarding Chris's comment about the electronic health record and the patient portal and how this investment in digitizing information and connecting people, the provider community through this network, adds to the outcome of using telehealth. Dr. New.
So to piggyback on what you said, Chris, I mean, something we've done have noticed that telehealth lended us an opportunity to do is to be disruptive a little bit. The typical model for stroke care is the hub and spoke model. So there's a central, sort of centralized, high quality care. The other hospitals that are in the vicinity that need any higher level of care, they just, you know, transfer patients out of their communities to the hub. And essentially, what we've done is at Hartford was, especially in the era now that, you know, stroke symptoms could potentially be treated up to 24 hours from their onset using advanced technology and screening, we put that screening technology out in our spokes and using telehealth, being able to screen people outside of the hub and making a decision about if they are better off treated at the hub or being transferred in, rather than the traditional practice of just transferring everybody who we think may need this to the hub and screening them and triaging there. So that not only decongests the system, but also allows families to not have to travel across the state if they don't need to do that. And it's been a very successful model. It's been great.
And it's fascinating even to have David on from Louisiana with this completely different geography than we have here in our state of Connecticut. That it shows you that looking around the country, there are and have to be very different approaches, because geographically what they're going through is going to have to stay this hub and spoke. What we have, you have created many hubs, and that's really valuable and important to the people in this community.
Yeah, and I'd like to go around the horn here with each of our guests this morning and just hear a little bit as you think about the near-term future, the next 3 years. What are you excited about in terms of this development? Can we go, Dr. Houghton, your point of view about what's getting you excited about what's coming?
Sure, yeah. And let me also say to Chris and Amre and John, you guys are doing some really remarkable things up there, and I think it's in line with a lot of the ideas that we had to try to harness the existing investments that we've made as a health system. In your case with Epic, we're also with Epic. We're using the same technology to create those virtual visits through MyChart. And so I think recognizing that the next 3 years will likely show a continued movement forward with the acceptability of telehealth to our patients, we need to continue to push the envelope to create different and unique ways to reach our patients wherever they are, whenever they need it, to really give that right touch at the right place in the right time. And for us, we're always reminded that some of this may be active with connections where the patient reaches out and makes the next appointment virtually, as we're doing now. It's found it may be passive with other digital technologies, collecting blood pressures and finger stick glucose readings at home. We've made an investment with a company called TidoCare that allows us to have a home diagnostic device that comes as part of the Oktra Anywhere Care Health Kit. So they can, as a patient, you can look in the ear, you can look in the throat, you can listen to heart tones, and you can forward that information to the physician on the other side to help add that next piece of quality and really reach the appropriateness of telehealth. So I think that's what I'm most excited about is combining active and passive and utilizing new technologies to just bring more and more care to more and more people.
That's exciting. Dr. Sampietro is the physician in chief for behavioral health services at Hartford Healthcare. What's in your near-term crystal ball?
I want to pick up with what David said about pushing the envelope. One of the things we didn't specifically call out, but you heard in the conversation, is that telehealth is not just a tool to make our current system more scalable or bionic in some ways. It actually itself is something that allows for innovation to happen, because it breaks up our usual way of doing things. So that was one of the things that we noticed in creating that virtual telehealth or behavioral health team, was that all of a sudden we could do it in a completely different way, because we weren't bound by the bricks and mortar or the back stairwell, as David said. So I'm very much looking forward to, and there was really an imperative, I think, that we were feeling at the time, and I think most, if not all, systems are feeling that felt something like You know, if what are the odds we're going to look back in 5 years and feel that we didn't, you know, move aggressively enough in this space because the consumers are demanding it. So very much looking forward to working with Chris. We're actually launching telepsychiatry here at Hartford Healthcare on the 6th of May.
So close.
Through our MATCH program, a medication-assisted treatment for people with substance use, struggling with substance use disorders. So very much looking forward to that right on the horizon.
Yeah, very exciting. Dr. New is the Chief of Stroke Services. What's on your wish list here? What's coming?
I think that the next 3 years are going to be exciting. The next maybe five or so will be seeing a lot more wearable technology. We'll be seeing a lot more sort of back and forth, not just sort of one-sided communication where it's a point of service. I think that what was touched on earlier with getting bioinformatics plugged into EMR automatically. We know that the projection is about in 2017, 20 million virtual visits in the country. It's projected to be 105 million in the next 5 years. Mm. So that space is going to be filled, and we're looking at a 50,000 doctor shortage by 2030. There's no other way for us to do this in the country without filling the space with this technology. So we look forward to the changes.
And it can speak ultimately to the affordability of healthcare as well in a significant way.
Precisely.
Yes.
I think it has to. I feel like that is the imperative. And Chris, you too.
So I'm excited for the cultural transformation that I see beginning to happen around telehealth. And I guess it's back to that trust issue. You know, as customers trust it, as we trust it, as we develop our skills around really engaging in this kind of care, that's just going to create, in my opinion, an explosion in the right direction.
Yeah. It's really an exciting time. And of course, with any new technology like this, there are things that are getting in the way of it really exploding sooner rather than later. And I'd like to spend a few minutes with our guests talking about that. I'll just start off because this is where I live. The payment for these services are not broadly accepted from insurance companies and state policies across the country. Today, there's tremendous variation state by state. David, I know in Louisiana, through some of the pioneering work that you and Ochsner have done and others, there's more support and payment for these services. Connecticut, the land of steady habits, not so much just yet. So I'd be interested in people's point of view about both the payment and other important barriers that we're going to have to deal with sooner rather than later. Anybody want to jump in first?
David, why don't you take that first?
Sure. So there are parity laws across the country. I think there's 27 or 28 states now that have their legislatures that have written parity laws. And what that means is that the same level of service provided virtually is to be paid for by third-party payers if it's the same as what would happen in bricks and mortar. Any loopholes with that, right? So if you feel like it wasn't exactly the same thing provided or if the law is written almost too narrowly, there's plenty of opportunities for the payers to not cover the services. And so it's a good point, Elliot, that there's a lot of differences out there. One reason that we've continued to push forward, however, is that we find value in other places. And so we recognize not only is it the right thing for the patients, but for our state, there's unique opportunities for small hospitals that we've partnered with to keep their doors open. We've had no rural hospital closures in the state of Louisiana in the last 5 years, and part of that is because of affiliations and the ability to partner with other hospital systems. We know that that allows the unemployment rates to stay lower. We know that that allows our patients to live healthier lives. John mentioned earlier those downstream benefits of points on the hemoglobin A1C scale. These translate into real dollars of productivity, in fact, in a community. When your community stays healthier, patients are staying out of the ERs, patients are not overutilizing other avenues of care. So as we move towards value-based care from fee-for-service, a lot of these barriers drop as well. And I think all of us know that it's only a matter of time, just like it was only a matter of time for the cell phone industry to expand to smartphones and only a matter of time for Netflix to put Blockbuster out of business.
Right.
Fascinating. Dr. New, your perspective.
I think one of the biggest things outside of the finances of how to make this viable is the issue of the acceptance. You know, earlier it was announced that I think Tesla in 2020, as soon as that, can start having some driverless taxis. I don't know anybody in the room here, but I wouldn't even get into a car without a driver at this stage.
Yeah, me neither.
Okay. I think part of that
I'm going to talk to you in 15 years as you take that driverless cab over here for the radio show.
So I think getting on board with that and getting, you know, that breaking that barrier is really going to be the key challenge for some folks. And even from the provider side, you know, and the folks who are on this show are very passionate about this and have a breadth of knowledge, but there are some providers there who still traditionally feel that, you know, there's not it's not the same thing. And I think we're going to see generations change into that. And as we train our incoming generations of providers to do this, I think that's going to be something that's going to take some time. There's also a barrier there.
Yeah, I think that the notion of protecting the traditional business model is a piece of what you're speaking about. And that happens with mostly every new innovation, is that there are some resistors early on. But the push from the consumer, and for so many of the reasons that we've been talking about here this morning, it just makes it's an undeniable force.
And you've spoken so much, Elliot, about value and making sure you can see how this fits into that value equation and makes healthcare, this is the imperative for all of us, makes healthcare better and more affordable. That would be critical. John Seta, PHO, your thoughts?
Yeah, we in healthcare, which is a system in a lot of transformation, we often use this metaphor of trying to build the plane while it's flying or fix the plane while it's flying, and this is another example of that. How do we, you know, build the system before, you know, in some ways we have the fuel? My own experience with that in behavioral health was that, first of all, there's not a whole lot of investment required for behavioral health. There's not a lot of resources that it takes. So I was able to be in a moment where we stood up the program investing in it and saw the utility of it. And then quite literally, CMS has come out with codes to support, you know, that behavioral health integration into primary care. So I'm very much convinced of the inevitability. Somebody I was talking with described it, you know, with respect to behavioral health integration into primary care, but maybe all of what we're saying. He said, "You remember when there were suitcases that didn't have wheels on them, and then there were wheels on them, and there's no going back." So I echo. I think David had sort of spoken to the inevitability of this. So then the question is, where are you in any given moment in a system relative to, you know, are the codes built yet? Is the fuel there yet? And are you, how do you stay current and not fall behind and be ready for the fuel when it comes?
Yeah, we use the analogy when we talk about innovation about the bag phone that weighed probably, what, 10 pounds? That's some folks.
And cost $10 a minute.
Right, that some people were able to afford, much less able to carry around. Mm-hmm. And look what's happened in a relatively short period of time. I think this is a very similar kind of trend. Others, Chris, your point of view?
So I have to say, I remember the first time I saw one of those bag phones. I was in Chicago. It must have been 1987. And I was so impressed. I thought This person must be the president of a country. I think there's cracks of light, as we've all suggested. And, you know, this year, for example, Medicare has released some new codes. So they're slowly starting to change the way they're thinking about telehealth and using it. And then Medicare Advantage. I think there's a lot of opportunities on the horizon there as well as we go into 2020.
What about the notion of privacy, confidentiality, cybersecurity? How does anyone have some thoughts about those issues and what you're experiencing with that may be causing reticence to move forward?
The public's concerns. Yeah. Do you hear that a lot, physicians? David?
Yeah, sure. I'll take that. You know, it's interesting. We don't hear a lot from our patients worried about that. I think it, again, is a paradigm shift in the way that the vast majority of us now don't think twice about having our credit card autofill from our smartphone or are not the least bit concerned about online banking. I saw a statistic recently in 2000, less than 1% of households did any online banking, and now that number is better than 75%.
Sure.
And that's, you know, that's the notion of what has just become expected. Now, with the advent of good security policies for things like online banking, hospitals have been able to piggyback onto those technologies. And so we're, you know, proud that the companies that we've partnered with to help power our telehealth solutions, as well as maintain our patient health information records through Epic, we feel comfortable with it. And I think we are able to translate that level of confidence to our patients so they feel comfortable with it also.
And then as we are getting closer to the end of our hour, I know, David, that you, in a different lifetime, worked with the CDC. And I do think that there are tremendous and wonderful implications for world health, global health, making sure that we can bring the best care to folks who may not have it in a much more affordable way. Is that something that's discussed?
It is. And you're exactly right. More than 20 years ago, I worked for a couple of years at the CDC in Atlanta. That's when I got my master's in public health and epidemiology. And it was important then, as it is important now, for building any new healthcare programs, looking at all the barriers that we talked about today, to get down to some common denominators. And these that publishes the five A's. Is it available? Is it accessible? Is it affordable? Is it acceptable? And that's really that. As we mentioned, there's that level of trust. And is it appropriate? And I think that may be the linchpin of all this, is the appropriateness really speaks to the quality. And I think the translatability of virtual care and telehealth is widespread and vast. And whether it's the next 3 years or 30 years, I think it's going to be really exciting times for us to be able to expand this, not only nationally, but also internationally.
Very exciting times, very exciting topic, an amazing group of folks today.
Yes, we are with the pioneers today, and we appreciate your willingness to spend some time with us this morning sharing this point of view about what is really a burgeoning big innovation in healthcare that has so much potential going forward. And we're happy and proud at Hartford Healthcare to be one of the pioneers as well. So, Chris Peterson, in fact, specifically to you, but to everybody on this call with us and others back home, we appreciate your pioneering spirit in driving us forward in this innovative space.
A big thank you to our guests, Dr. David Houghton, Dr. Omri New, Chris Peterson, and Dr. John Santopietro. We appreciate all of you. We hope you had a great time with us, and we will be here next month.
This has been Healthcare Matters, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare. Tune in next month as we continue to discuss the status of healthcare, determine what works and what doesn't, and work to bridge the gap. Healthcare Matters on WTIC, News Talk 1080 at WTIC.com. We're